Well, we're past halfway in this book. This, of course, is, I think, the biggest chapter in the book. It's long and it's substantial as well. Chapter 6, the holy justice of God. It's not only atheists, old and new, that have struggled with the God of the Old Testament. As R.C. Sproul says in this chapter of the holiness of God, some of the greatest Christians in the world have struggled with the God of the Old Testament, including Martin Luther and the Apostle Paul. How to reconcile God's holy justice with the seeming brutality of his judgments, especially in the Old Testament. It's often something, I'm sure, that's thrown up to us when we try to talk to people about the Bible. Sproul does deal with some of the objections, but really quite briefly, initially. And he looks at some of the solutions that some people have tried to propose as a way of getting around the difficulty of this problem. But he dismisses these accommodations, these compromises, pretty quickly, and moves on to, as he says, stare the Old Testament God in the face and look at the hardest passages in the Old Testament in order to try and explain and defend God in these situations. So that includes the judgment of Nadab and Abihu for offering an unauthorized sacrifice in Leviticus 10, the judgment on Uzzah for touching the ark, the capital punishment for multiple crimes, the command given to slaughter thousands of Canaanites, and ultimately, as we'll see, the killing of Christ on the cross. So, turning to your outline, this is actually quite a difficult chapter to outline and summarize, but we have what we have there. Right up front, Dr. Sproul says, whoever reads the Old Testament must struggle with the apparent brutality of God's judgment found there. As I've said earlier, he looks at these three options as a way of getting around it, which is reject Christianity altogether, turn the Old Testament into a myth, or argue that the Old Testament God is different to the New Testament God, none of which are acceptable. So then he just dives straight in, looking at Nadab and Abihu, sons of Aaron who offered this strange fire to God were immediately executed. And then he explains how some people, again, have tried to moderate this somewhat with the idea that they were experimenting with different kinds of oil and it just so happened that the oil exploded and killed them. No, he says, that's a mere human explanation. God's explanation is this. The Bible makes it clear that their death was not an accident, but a judgment. Aaron ran to Moses to plead the cause of his sons, but Moses answered that they had committed a sin of arrogance, an act of treason against God, and they had profaned a most holy place. And I think part of the problem, why we have a problem, or many have a problem, is we've lost the idea of punitive justice. So much of justice today is about rehabilitation, re-education, but very little is about actual punishment, retribution, eye for an eye, and so on. And yet, that is very much central to the whole idea of God's dealings with sinners. He says punitive justice is the justice by which God punishes the guilty. And it's the idea that punishment must fit the crime. The punishment is severe when the crime is awful. And then Nadab and Abihu's case, they couldn't plead ignorance. They'd been warned. They'd been told. People still say, but wasn't their judgment a bit harsh? Well, Sproul says it comes back again and again to the holiness of God. If God is holy, God is just in all his acts, in all his ways. Then he moves on to Uzzah, where this was centered around this ark that they were carrying along, and it should have been on certain types of poles and so on. Some of these things were not observed. The ark falls off. Uzzah reaches out to steady the ark and dies immediately. God just strikes him dead. And even David struggled with this. David was angry with God about it. Again, people come in with human explanations trying to defend God. They think, well, this is awful severe, so let's try and distance God from this. So they say, well, Uzzah respected the ark so much that he actually died of fright after he touched it. Sproul says, people reach for such explanations not only because our culture has an incurable allergy to all things supernatural, but also because the story so offends our sense of justice. People say, well, it was an instinctive reaction. He just did what any godly Jew would have done. It was a reflex. It wasn't premeditated defiance. Well, these are all human explanations. God's explanation in the Word is he should have known better. Again, he was a Kohathite, special family branch of the Levites who'd been given very strict instructions about how to care for the ark. He knew from Numbers, you touch any holy thing, you die. But he touched it. An act of arrogance, a sin of presumption. And I think here, I believe, is the key sentence. Uzzah assumed that his hand was less polluted than the earth. That was his miscalculation. He thought the worst thing that could happen was for this ark to touch the ground. And God is saying, no, the worst thing that could happen is for this ark to touch a human hand. So he wasn't innocent. He wasn't punished unjustly. Then he takes a little detour into some biblical concepts of justice, just reflecting back on these two instances of Nadab and Abihu on one hand and Uzzah on the other. And he's saying, yes, these are stories which show the divine justice. God plays by the rules. The ultimate norm of justice is his own holy character. In both of these cases, they had been warned, both of the crime and the punishment of it. They weren't ignorant. They'd been given special knowledge. God here is not being unjust. Injustice violates righteousness. And then he moves on to Old Testament capital offenses. And he's saying, you know, you look at all these crimes, it's not just murder, there are other crimes, like even adultery or a rebellious child, where the penalty in the Old Testament is given as death. So it seems like the Old Testament God is harsher. And yet again, I love the way Sproul just turns thinking on its head at times and goes in a completely unexpected direction. And what he says is this Old Testament list of all these capital offenses is actually a massive reduction in capital crimes from the original list. He says the Old Testament law is a list of astonishing grace. What does he mean? Well, he's saying, God said, in the day you sin, you shall die. Every single sin deserves death. It deserves capital punishment. Not only death, but instant death. The slightest sin is an act of defiance against cosmic authority. And he quotes Hans Kung, who says that the most mysterious aspect of the mystery of sin is not that the sinner deserves to die, but rather that the sinner in the average situation continues to exist. God is so slow to anger that when his anger does erupt, we are shocked and offended by it. Sproul says the Old Testament is a record of the God who is patient in the extreme. So he doesn't go on the offensive. He goes on the attack. He doesn't step back and try and shield God from this. No, he goes for the sinner making the accusations. Then, Roman numeral 6, the conquest of Canaan. Again, survey some human explanations. Hebrews were just ruthless and just pursuing a ruthless kind of politics. It wasn't God that's behind this. No, that's not true. God commanded it. Indeed, even before this slaughter, God killed just about everybody in the world at the time of the flood. He says, we assume the people of Canaan were innocent, but they were not. I saw an article through the week that I think put this really well. You know, if you think of what's happening in the Middle East just now with ISIS, they are the Philistines of our day. They are the Canaanites of our day. That's the kind of people that we're talking about here. That's the kind of cruelty and malice and evil that was manifested throughout the Canaanite region. Though they were not innocent people. He says, Sproul says, to the Canaanites, God poured out justice. To the Jews, God poured out mercy. God was punishing the Canaanites, insult to his holiness, while at the same time preparing a land and a nation for the holy purpose of the coming Messiah. And then in what I think is the most moving section of this chapter, he then goes into the New Testament. So you see he's taking the Old Testament passages, he's turning them against the accusers, and he's basically saying, you don't know how bad you are, and you don't know how holy God is. And then takes people to the God of the New Testament, who's supposed to be much more benign and loving and gentle, and goes to Christ's crucifixion. And there's a section there in this black book. It's on page 147. I'll just read some of this. The false conflict between the two testaments may be seen in the most brutal act of divine vengeance ever recorded in Scripture. It's not found in the Old Testament, but in the New. The most violent expression of God's wrath and justice is seen in the cross. If ever a person had room to complain of injustice, it was Jesus. He was the only innocent man ever to be punished. If we stagger at the wrath of God, let's stagger at the cross. Here is where our astonishment should be focused. If we have cause for moral outrage, let it be directed at Golgotha. He goes on, the cross was at once the most horrible and the most beautiful example of God's wrath. It was the most just and the most gracious act in history. God would have been more than unjust. He would have been diabolical to punish Jesus if Jesus had not first willingly taken on himself the sins of the world. I just think that whole page is outstanding. And in terms of an insight into the character of God and as a defense of God, the God of the Old Testament is really, there's no better argument, you might say. You want the God of the New Testament, do you? Okay, well, let's look at the God of the New Testament, shall we? Come with me to Calvary and we'll see. Oh yes, we'll see great love for sure. But we'll see also great holiness and great justice and pure and holy divine vengeance and retribution. He gives a couple more examples of taking grace for granted. And he talks about how grace no longer amazes us. We just get used to it. We expect it. We think we're entitled to it. He says we've come to expect God to be merciful, and from there the next step is easy. We demand it. We think we deserve more grace, but grace, by definition, is undeserved. So, I think this chapter, though it's long and it's meaty and it's challenging, is the most outstanding chapter in the book and deserves a lot of rereading. I actually think it's one of the greatest chapters that Sproul has ever written. And what I'd like to do in just a few minutes we've got left is, instead of going through these individual examples again, Nadab and Abihu and Uzzah and Canaanite slaughter, capital crimes, Christ's crucifixion, I want to try and draw together some lessons from these taken as a whole. First of all, God's judgments were pre-announced. So in these cases of Nadab, Abihu, and Uzzah, God can't be accused of unexpected judgment, of arbitrary judgment. God gave clear instructions and unmistakable prohibitions and clear announcement of sanctions beforehand. So these were not sins of ignorance. These were sins done with full knowledge of the facts. So God's judgments were pre-announced. Secondly, God's judgments are holy. We need to hold on to that as well. His justice is according to his character, which is holy. His justice is never divorced from his righteousness. He never condemns the innocent. He never clears the guilty. He never punishes with undue severity. God's judgments are holy. Thirdly, God's judgments are delayed. The New Testament does seem to reduce the capital crimes, but as Sproul said, even the Old Testament is a reduction of capital crimes. Instant death for every sin. So the Old Testament, like the New, is a record of grace, because God doesn't punish every single sin with death and doesn't do it immediately. So the issue is not why does God punish sin, but why does he permit ongoing human rebellion and ongoing human existence? The Old Testament is a record of a God who is patient in the extreme with a rebellious people, delaying the full measure of his justice so that grace would have time to work. Then, fourthly, God's judgments are against sin. And that's part of our problem. We don't understand God's justice because we don't understand the nature of sin, which, as Sproul says, is cosmic treason. It's treason against a pure and perfect sovereign. It's a misrepresentation of God who calls us to image him in front of others. In commanding the Israelites to slaughter the Canaanites, God was not giving injustice to Canaan and justice to Israel. He was giving justice to Canaan and mercy to Israel. Then fifthly, God's judgments were approved by Jesus. Jesus called the God of the Old Testament Father. It was the Old Testament God who sent his Son to save the world. And the Old Testament God's will that Jesus came to do. It was zeal for the Old Testament God who slew Nadab, Abihu, and Uzzah that consumed Christ. The zeal of your house has eaten me up. Then sixthly, God's greatest judgment was experienced by Jesus. The most powerful act of divine vengeance in the Bible, the most violent expression of God's wrath and justice, is seen at the cross. It is at the one and the same time the most great, just and the most gracious act in history. And then lastly, God's judgments destroy entitlement. I think that's why most people really hate this whole idea, because we love to feel entitled, that we've deserved something. Since we take grace for granted, God reminded Israel through his judgments that grace must never be assumed. God's judgments challenge our secret sense of entitlement and changes the question from, why doesn't God save everybody? To, why did God save me? If we insist on getting on what we deserve, we will get justice and not mercy. So, by way of summary, God's judgments were pre-announced. God's judgments are holy. God's judgments are delayed. God's judgments are against sin. God's judgments were approved by Jesus. The greatest judgment was experienced by Jesus. And God's judgments destroy entitlement. So I'm sure you have some questions today, surely. Any thoughts about that chapter? How have you handled this? I mean, we all get it. Whenever you speak to somebody about the Bible, you get the Old Testament thrown in your face. What have you found useful? Or is there anything here you think will be useful? Yes, Misty. So the question is, so there are older people which it's okay to kill, but the babies it's not okay to kill. Is that to put it bluntly, okay? Anyone get any answers for Misty? How would you deal with that? Bill? Right.
And so it's, if you are going to eradicate something or someone, you don't leave descendants or offspring.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that sounds coarse, but I guess it's ISIS have children too, for example.
Mm-hmm.
They're even training children.
They are.
I don't know how much the Canaanites allowed children to be part of their killing sprees, but they must have witnessed something. And it hardened them. And so when you remove the adult population, the kids are like, okay, now it's our turn.
Yeah, I always remember, that's right, Bill. I always remember after 9/11, there was film of some streets in Palestine where everyone was celebrating what had happened. And I always remember the camera zooming in on these kids. And they were, I don't know what ages they were, but they looked like from maybe, teenage all the way down to 3 and 4 years old. And they're all celebrating and rejoicing and chanting anti-American, anti-Jewish songs. So you've already got there at a very young age, kids already poisoned against certain peoples. And I remember a commentator on the Arab world talking about what Muslim mothers whisper into the ears of their children from the moment they are born. I can't remember the exact statement, but it's 3 or 4 words about the Jews being pigs and things like that. And like that's the Jewish mother used to whisper into the child's ears from the moment they were born, the Hebrew equivalent of "Into thy hands I commit my spirit." That was the first words they learned, and it's interesting that was Jesus' last words on the cross. But the Muslim mother pours in this hate and this malice from the earliest days. So, yeah, you could, you know, take out all the 10-year-olds and up, and yet as soon as they grow up, you've got kids who even subconsciously are full of hatred against God's people.